First, a very brief roundup of the week's top stories from Physicians First Watch, and then we'll chat with Drs. Bobby Byrne and Amy Starmer about their study of compensation for women pediatricians. Here are this week's top stories from Physicians First Watch. Amy Herman is off this week, so please bear with my pronunciations. First up, the FDA is warning that some ranitidine products, Zantac for example, contain low levels of nitrosamine impurity that's a probable carcinogen. The agency is investigating and advising worried patients to discuss the issue with their clinicians. Next, dapagliflozin, an SGL2 inhibitor usually used in diabetes, has been confirmed to lower the risk for worsening heart failure in some patients. An international placebo-controlled study found a number needed to treat of 21 to prevent a case of worsening heart failure or cardiovascular death. It was published in NEJM. Metformin has a better cardiovascular safety profile than sulfonylureas in patients with diabetes and reduced kidney function, according to a JAMA study. An editorialist writes that the findings support the use of metformin, quote, as the first-line treatment to which other diabetes medications are added, even as early chronic kidney disease develops. Our final story. Sexual violence, in particular, coerced sexual initiation that some 7% of women in the U.S. report having experienced, is linked with several adverse health outcomes. These include unwanted first pregnancies, pelvic inflammatory disease, and problems with ovulation or menstruation. Now stay tuned for our interview about women pediatricians, their compensation, and their household duties. Welcome to another episode of Clinical Conversations. We're going to chat with Drs. Bobby Byrne and Amy Starmer, two of the authors of a paper in pediatrics that uses a large national sample to characterize just how much less women pediatricians are being paid than men. Dr. Byrne is a neonatologist and professor of pediatrics and vice chair of the Department of Pediatrics at the Indiana University School of Medicine. She also serves on the advisory committee for the American Academy of Pediatrics Longitudinal Study of Pediatricians. Dr. Starmer is a primary care pediatrician and an assistant professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. She is associate medical director of quality in the Department of Pediatrics at Boston Children's Hospital. She also serves on the advisory committee for AAP's longitudinal study. Welcome, both of you, to Clinical Conversations.
Thanks for having us.
We should start, as your article does, with some basic facts. Among them, that half of all recent medical school graduates are women, and that women compose almost two-thirds of the pediatrician workforce. In American society at large, women are paid less than men for equal work. And I'm not reminding you of that fact, and people who are listening who don't know it have probably been living in caves or something. But that's where we are. So your group decided to study the exact contours of that underpayment for early and mid-career women pediatricians, actually for all early and mid-career pediatricians, and then you went to the gender aspect of it. How did you go about doing that examination?
Yeah, Bobby, you want to take that? Mm-hmm. We have been looking at this longitudinal study, and we found this rich data source that our participants were willing to share with us. And they tell us sometimes the things that they want to talk about, and sometimes we come up with topics. And this was probably a result of a little bit of both, them talking to us about their work-life balance and pay and loan repayment schedules, but also our interest in knowing that we have more and more women who are in pediatrics and more women in pediatrics who have debt as they come out of medical school. And so we really thought that this was a good time to look at from a longitudinal perspective, or at least get a snapshot right now of where women are in the pediatric workforce, what they're getting paid, and how that might relate a little bit to their satisfaction with their career.
So, Dr. Byrne, what was the rough size of the sample that you measured?
It was about 1,000 people. So I think the exact number was 998, but approximately 1,000 participants in the study.
And Dr. Starmer, what were the areas of work of the people that you chose to examine?
One of the really unique things about this project is that we had the opportunity to include pediatricians who work in all sorts of different care settings. So it wasn't a study just focused on primary care pediatricians or just pediatricians working in academic settings. We had a very rich variety in terms of pediatricians all across the different career fields, which was very helpful.
And you asked them a number of questions, among which was, okay, so how much money do you make before taxes? And so these were all self-reported incomes.
That's right. And, you know, the income was certainly part of what we asked about. But I think the unique part about this project is that this was a study looking at the income and wages of pediatricians nested within this broader ongoing longitudinal study where we have very rich and in-depth understanding of many different aspects of both work life and home life of early and mid-career pediatricians. So that was what really helped us to have a very robust analysis.
Add on to that, Joe, Amy is really right. This is such a large group that is really diverse. But I think the thing that makes this exceptionally unique is that we also really considered very specific things that might cause discrepancies in salary. And as a good example, we know that women in this age range are likely to have children. And when they have children, they may take off of work for some amount of time. And so we factored that into the analysis as well. So that's the detail to which we got down to really look at the salary discrepancies.
For example, some prior work has suggested a hypothesis that perhaps the reason why women are making less than men might have to do with the fact that they made a conscious decision that I actually would prefer to be at home to be with my children, and I'm willing to take a sacrifice in pay to have a work-life arrangement that would make that happen. And so we asked them to comment on the extent to which they actually made personal choices along those lines, which was really helpful to put into the final models of the analysis.
And the longitudinal study that you whose data you used was called the PLACE study, AAP's study of the pediatrician life and career experience. We won't talk about actual salary numbers, but I'm going to step us through the number of adjustments that were made. So first of all, there were four steps. The first step is, okay, so in terms of self-reported incomes, how much do women make vis-a-vis men? And the answer there is they earn only 76% roughly of what male pediatricians are making.
That's correct.
And then the second step is, okay, so let's adjust that raw data for labor force characteristics. For instance, hours worked and the subspecialty. So, for instance, you would expect a pediatric neurosurgeon to make more than a general practice pediatrician.
That's right. Right.
Okay. And so taking that step, we now come closer to 87%. So we go from women earning 76% as much as men to women earning 87% as much as men when you take those factors into account. And the next step, go ahead. You look like you wanted to say something.
I just wanted to comment on that particularly, that what we knew about our pediatricians was that one of the reasons why women may be choosing pediatrics more is because, and we don't know this for sure, but we know that there are opportunities for women to work part-time. There are opportunities for any pediatrician to work part-time in the field. And so we really thought it was important to look at, we knew that there were more women than men who were part-time, and making sure that you adjusted for that right off the bat was an important thing to look at to decrease that discrepancy right away, or to at least demonstrate why there might have been a discrepancy.
Okay, so that first step, that second step rather, included hours worked as well as subspecialty.
Correct.
Okay. Now, the next step was a kind of a labor force, the other characteristics plus the physician's specific job, for instance, what their workload is. So if you're expected to see 40 patients a day, or I don't know how many you're expected to see, but if you're expected to see, say, 40 patients a day, that's a higher workload than somebody seeing 20 patients a day.
Right. And in that category also, we looked at things like, were you the owner of a general pediatric practice, or were you a salaried employee? And did you work in a rural or a suburban area versus an urban area? So there were a lot of things in that second analysis that, you're right, looked at these specific job characteristics.
And so that got us to 91% of the similarly situated men. And the final step was the thing that we mentioned earlier, which is the choice to say, look, I want to spend more time at home, I want more flexible working hours, etc. And that adjustment brought us to 94% of what men were making.
Correct.
Okay. So now, so 94%, you know, starting from you know, 76% doesn't seem like a lot. However, we're left to confront this final adjustment, which gives us a 6% gap, which in many institutions is like a 2-year salary adjustment. You know, I mean, in some places you get 3% a year. I don't know what you guys get,
right.
but if you get 3% a year, let's say, that's 2 years worth of adjustments that women pediatricians are behind. All else being equal, so to speak. is that the number that you think that further efforts might be organized around?
I think it's a number and a really important place to start the conversation at, because I think that really taking all these, we know that the number of factors that contribute to the actual wage and salary that a physician may be bringing home is complex and multifactorial. And so that's why it was so important to take a comprehensive look at this and to really understand in more detail how these different types of factors contribute to differences in salary, which they definitely do. I think that's what the data is showing for us. But what we really tried to think very carefully about all these different categories of characteristics that might contribute. And the take-home point is that at the end of the day, there is still this significant difference, which, as you were just alluding to, even though it may sound like a small single percentage amount, over time that value gets compounded, and in the course of it, summing that up to the actual salary, it is a significant amount.
So just also given the number of women in pediatrics, that this is a large number of women who are working very hard, who feel very privileged to do the work that they do, yet, you know, why they're not getting compensated the same as men, it needs to be explored a lot further.
There was an interesting editorial. She said that that there were two, you examined a lot of things and a lot of factors, and one of them was the ethnic and racial minorities, the number of ethnic and racial minorities. And she says in her editorial, which I'm sure you've read, that the numbers were too small to do an analysis. And she said that in itself is a statement about.
We really wish we could break this down even further into, you know, what are African-American women who are pediatricians making compared to other pediatricians? We wish we had the numbers to do that. We certainly don't in places, but we're hoping that this sparks some discussion on that, and maybe we could look at that on in a broader or a bigger scale.
You know, and one of the things that caught my eye in the editorial was that she said that there is cause for cautious optimism. Now, I'm old enough to have been drafted to go to Vietnam, and cautious optimism was one of the things that we heard again and again. So I wonder whether you agree with that there is cause for cautious optimism, or whether 6% is 6%.
It is very hard to compare this particular study and analysis to research that has preceded this, at least when you're talking about direct comparisons of the percentages or, you know, what the gap exactly is, just because I think historically these studies have focused on different types of factors. And so I don't think that we could say that the fact that our study showed that the gap was a single percentage and it used to be closer to 20 or whatever the prior studies have said, that is evidence that we're making progress, because the studies were not meant to be directly compared in that way. And so I think that's really important to take into consideration. I also think the primary point of the study wasn't really to try to look at as a comparison over time. This was a cross-sectional look at where we are right now. And I think that's where we want to really have the conversation to be starting, is from now and moving forward.
What have your colleagues said to you since the study has come out? Have you had any water cooler conversations about, hey, good work, or?
Kind of a funny story that happened. We had a male pediatrician who is actually really quite an advocate for this study, but he said, well, this sounds great, you guys. This is really, the gap is really lowered to $8,000. And a female pediatrician looked at him and said, okay, I'll take my $8,000, please, then. So it was kind of a, you know, that's how I think many women might feel when you say, you know, it's only $8,000 difference. So.
And so the other, and we've been talking about money, but there was another study in the same issue. And the editorialist barely mentions it. And Dr. Starmer, you were the senior author. And Dr. Byrne, you were the first author, I think.
Just the reverse. Amy was the first author, and I was a senior author. Amy's been really passionate about this subject for a long time.
I'm sorry to mix that up. Okay. So so let's not ignore the study. The study was about, okay, so you go home, you're a pediatrician, you're a woman. Who does all the housework?
That's right, yeah.
So
yeah, who is doing it, Joe?
I'm not. If you looked around my apartment, I live alone, and you know that I don't do any housework. So tell me a bit about it.
This particular study was a unique opportunity to look at something we don't honestly talk that much about, which is what happens, as you were saying, after physicians go home, and how do those kinds of how they spend their time at home even impact of their professional lives and satisfaction and that kind of thing. So we had the opportunity to really look in detail at the distribution of how pediatricians allocate the different chores that are required in the home, whether they had primary responsibility for it versus their spouse, and compare those things and how they fall out according to gender, that kind of thing.
Yes, and as I look through the results, it looks pretty typical. I mean, you know, men are tasked with doing the repair work, and they sort of share financial responsibilities with women. Those are the two closest things, I think. But the other stuff, you know, childcare, cooking, doing the laundry.
Right. We looked at 19 different types of characteristics that kind of the primary types of responsibilities around the home, and 16 out of the 19 women reported being the ones to have primary responsibility for. And it's important to note that those gender differences persisted even after controlling for the typical types of factors that you might think would affect distribution of roles in the home, such as whether the pediatrician works part-time or has a physician spouse, those types of things that all might contribute to different types of distribution of that work.
And that was an important thing for Amy to really consider, because like I mentioned, we have many women pediatricians who are working part-time. And so if you think about it from that standpoint, it made sense maybe that some of the women pediatricians were doing more work around the house than their male counterparts. But it was fascinating to me that when Amy corrected for that we still had, you know, female pediatricians significantly making more contributions in the home than their male counterparts.
So let's go back to the pay disparity. And what do you hope will happen next? And Dr. Byrne?
We certainly hope that this stimulates discussion in a number of different places. Maybe you're the owner of your own private practice and you employ several pediatricians. We'd like you to look at your pay scale and ensure that you really feel like you have treated people equally. Maybe you're the department chair in a department of pediatrics, and again, you're reviewing your budget and you want to make sure that we're really doing a good job considering the job that women pediatricians are doing. So at least starting the discussion and having people start to reflect on their own payment practices would be a really good start.
Okay. Dr. Starmer, do you have anything to add to that?
I think that's great, Bobby. I think it's time to try to start the conversation and to really see where we can go in terms of even moving beyond just having individual leaders to take a look at what their own findings are, to try to think through programs and policies that will mitigate these types of disparities in the years ahead.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Drs. Byrne and Starmer, for taking the time to discuss this very important, these two very important papers with me today.
We really appreciate you giving, shedding light on this with us. Thank you so much, Joe.
Thanks so much. You're welcome.
That was our 234th episode. The whole searchable collection is available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. Let us know how we can improve these chats. Email me, jelia@nejm.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thank you for listening.